I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. Last month, a riotous mob stormed the Capitol, calling for the death of some of the country's top political leaders and demanding that the results of the presidential election be overturned. The rioters were angry, and much of the rest of the country was angry at them. The scholar Barbara Rosenwein has observed that anger can be both a vice and a virtue. She's chronicled how anger has been understood in different traditions and at different times, from the ancient Greeks to the present day. Barbara Rosenwein joins me to talk about her latest book, Anger, The Conflicted History of an Emotion. Plus, Midday theater critic Jay Wynn Russick reviews new digital offerings from the Roundhouse Theater and the Signature Theater. We'll get started right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. We begin today with an interview from the Midday Archive. It's a conversation I had last month about anger. Before I read this fascinating chronicle of emotional history, I'd never even thought about the fact that anger or any emotion could, in fact, have histories. Of the seven deadly sins, anger is number six, behind pride, greed, lust, envy, and gluttony. Sloth is the only sin, according to Pope Gregory and Thomas Aquinas, that is listed after anger on their famous hit parade. So maybe anger isn't so bad in the general scheme of things. Dr. Barbara Rosenwein observes that anger doesn't come preloaded into the human psyche. It must be learned. Buddhists try to avoid anger altogether. The ancient Roman Stoics said we should actively resist it because if we don't, we lose our capacity for rational judgment. Anger's history changed as society changed. Back in the days of feudalism, peasants weren't allowed to get angry, at least publicly. Anger is much discussed in the Bible. It is, in some instances, a metaphor for power, and it is the basis for a lucrative industry teaching people how to manage their anger. Particularly over the last 4 years with a brutish president who relied on insults and personal attacks in place of reasoned argument, it seems that much public discourse all too easily devolves into a blizzard of angry epithets. Well, that president is being impeached for inciting an angry mob to storm the Capitol, and videotape of that horrific event clearly shows the raw anger that animated many of the rioters. Anger may be an understandable response in a lot of situations, but is it productive? Is it in some cases necessary as a prerequisite to action? Or is anger simply a fog-inducing reflex that clouds our judgment to no productive end? Is anger a vice or a virtue? Dr. Barbara Rosenwein has thought a lot about that question and how our understanding of this basic emotion has changed over the millennia. Dr. Rosenwein is Professor Emerita at Loyola University Chicago and the author of many books. Her latest is called Anger, The Conflicted History of an Emotion. Our conversation was recorded earlier, so we aren't taking any new calls or online comments today. Barbara Rosenwein joined me on Zoom. Professor, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you for this fascinating book. Let me ask you to try to answer or at least frame this notion of anger being both a vice and a virtue. Where do you come down on that, one way or the other, or is it split down the middle?
Yeah, it's both, of course. Anger has a lot of good uses in our daily lives. It's not an unproductive feeling because once we express it, we are engaging socially. And if we express it in a way that makes it possible for others to adjust themselves to make the anger go away or at least fade or get mitigated. It's all to the good. And that's how we use anger most of the time in our daily lives. We get angry at our kids, but it's to change things. And as soon as they change, we are no longer angry at them. Other people get angry at us, and we see that they're upset, and we change too. So anger is a wonderful way to readjust our relationships and keep ourselves on a tranquil, even keel. On the other hand, if we get locked into our anger, if we feel that our anger has to do with an injustice that really cannot be solved except by violent means, if we feel that we are absolutely in the right and we cannot even see the point of view of others, then anger has a way of becoming a vice. The irony of what I'm saying is that traditionally, historically, the distinction between anger as a virtue and a vice was almost the opposite of what I'm saying. That is, someone like St. Augustine would say, we should never get angry at other people. Then it's a vice and it leads to all sorts of terrible things. But if we get angry on behalf of God, if our anger comes from the outrage that we have about sin, then it's righteous, then it's godly, then it can brook no compromise. So in a way, I've shifted the historical tradition in answering your question. The tradition, however, is that the righteous anger is the good anger. And I think partly because of that long historical tradition, people feel justified in getting locked into their anger.
And that's one of the things that was so fascinating to me about this book, is that even the notion that there is a history, that there is a tradition of anger. And you talk about Buddha and Seneca, the ancient Roman Stoic, and the Neo-Stoics, and anger's the way anger informs Christianity and religion in general. And we have anger management courses and advice, you know, all over the place in our current age. So this notion that there even is a history of anger is fascinating. Do you think there's a parallel history of love, a history of compassion, a history of, you know, name your emotion?
Absolutely.
That's analogous? Yeah.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I've just finished a manuscript on the history of love.
Yeah. I know that's a great novel by Nicole Krauss. I love that book.
That's right.
I look forward to yours as well.
Thank you. But even if you think that we are all hardwired to feel certain particular basic emotions, and many scientists really equate these with English words, so that anger, love, sadness, these are English words. Other languages have very, very different words. But even if we believe that, even if we think that these things are hardwired, which I don't, and I have a lot of backing even by neuroscientists, even if we think that, the emotions that we value, the emotions that we would like to suppress, the emotions that we think should be expressed volubly, those that should be quietly expressed, those that we want to share with others, so on. All of this changes not only in the course of time, but it also changes, or let's say it's felt and experienced differently in different groups at the same time. That's why I sort of thought of, coined the idea of emotional communities, groups that feel about, share, value, devalue certain emotions rather similarly, so that they feel very comfortable being together. And these also change over time. So that history is very complicated, because you're not just talking about everybody feeling the same way about anger or about love or about compassion, but different groups having very different takes on these feelings.
And is there some then uniformity throughout history in the way people experience these emotions? I mean, did people get angry in a fundamentally different way in Seneca's time, or in the first century Palestine, then they get angry now?
Absolutely.
This is what you mean by this notion of emotional communities?
Partly, but what you're talking about is sort of dominant senses of the importance or the unimportance or the goodness or the badness of an emotion. And a historian can trace that, because you can look at the dominant voices. What I mean by emotional communities is that there are also minority groups. One of the things that's happened in our own time is that these minority groups, once they find each other via social media, for example, suddenly do become sort of closed off silos rather than hearing the chatter of all the other groups. Mostly through history, you've got a lot of chatter. You've got marginal groups that hear the majoritarian groups. The majoritarian groups at times come in contact with the minority groups. But today, not everybody, but a lot of people are kind of locked into their own emotional community. And it's very hard now. I think what we see, when we talk about there's so much anger at Washington, D.C., during the insurrection, we're talking about really a minority voice, but it's sort of amplified by social media, by the news, by the president, and but most people today, I would argue, are not particularly happy to be angry. Would like not to privilege that emotion over others.
Well, but there do seem to be enough people who do sort of make a living being angry. You know, I mean, it's part of their brand. So whether they privilege it or not, you know, which is interesting. But I was fascinated that you offer no specific definition of anger.
That's right.
Because you punt that one. Yeah.
I punted, because in fact we've really lost a huge vocabulary of angry-like feelings that express much better than this catch-all term how people are feeling and what they're experiencing. Anger, there's many kinds of anger. There's sad anger. There's outraged anger. There's anger because I've been dissed. There's anger because I'm ashamed. And in the past, we had numerous ways. We still do. I mean, we have a huge vocabulary. We still can read Shakespeare. But if you make an engram, for example, of words that express anger, like frustrated. I'm frustrated. I'm angry. I'm outraged. I'm embittered. You'll see that anger has really jumped up in a way that these other words have not. So in part, people make a living out of anger because it's become a catch-all term that's so easy to use that and covers a multitude of sins that it almost has lost its meaning, but it still does have emotional force.
The book is called Anger, The Conflicted History of an Emotion. The author is my guest, Dr. Barbara Rosenwine. We'll have more with Dr. Rosenwine after a quick break. Our conversation was recorded last month, so we're not able to take any new calls or online comments today. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up a little later today, we'll have a theater review from our theater critic, J. Wynn Russick. She'll talk about two virtual productions, The Catastrophist at the Roundhouse Theater in Bethesda, and Simply Sondheim, a review at Signature Theater in Arlington, Virginia. And coming up tomorrow, a conversation with the novelist Chang Ray Lee about his terrific new novel, My Year Abroad. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Dr. Barbara Rosenwine. Her latest book is called Anger, The Conflicted History of an Emotion. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not taking any new calls or comments. Dr. Rosenwine, if you don't mind, we're going to go to the phones to Karen, who's listening from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Barbara Rosenwine.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Hope you guys are doing okay.
Thanks.
We are. Thanks.
Good. So I just retired last May after 43 years as a nurse, primarily in oncology and ICU. And what I started to observe or understand pretty early in my career was that anger was often, there was a lot of pain, fear, and loss behind anger. And that often in my experience, I'm not going to give stories because they would be extremely triggering for a lot of people, that when a family member reacted in anger and sometimes violence or threats of violence against us, it was because they were so overwhelmed with fear, pain, and loss about the diagnosis that their loved one was facing. In fact, it's interesting because usually the patient, and so I did adult nursing too, the patient, most of the time, they could get angry. Some of them did. But it was usually more, you know, God forbid, the parent of a child diagnosed with leukemia. That was a story that I told on my Facebook page the other day. I'm not going to say it online, but I mean on the air, but it was more like that. So I think that a lot of what's going on, especially in the world right now and politically, a lot of it is explained by that. And we have to try to have some understanding, compassion, not of illegal acts, but, yeah, you know, of what's going on, why people are so angry. And it's not, you know, anger is always pain, fear, and loss. And that's my observation.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Karen. That's a good point. And Dr. Rosenwine, I wonder, do you think that pain, fear, and loss are an antecedent to anger, or are they synonymous with anger?
Neither one. They're both. Mm-hmm. That is, often pain, fear, and loss are expressions of sense of helplessness. Helplessness leads to a sense of shame. And shame, to be shamed, to feel ashamed, especially in our culture, kind of triggers that sense of being dishonored and being angry. One of the, I really like your observation, Karen, because one of the things that I noticed in researching this book is that there are some languages in which something like sadness is included in the meaning of anger. Anger doesn't English has this one precise word. But other languages have different words that can mean a combination of anger, angry, sad, sorrowfully angry. While English sort of dissects emotions in a particular kind of way, other languages, other cultures do it differently. Would that we had a word that expresses what you discovered about your patients and their relatives, a word that wasn't just anger, but was something else, where they could, because if they had that word, they could feel more fully what it was they were experiencing and perhaps not be so frustrated that, for example, they would become violent. Because if you think that the only way to express these feelings is through anger, then that's how you do it. But I really like your sense of sort of the underlying emotions for which these people have no ready vocabulary, not at the moment at any rate.
Barbara Rosenwein from Loyola University, Chicago, where she's an emerita professor. The book is called Anger, The Conflicted History of an Emotion. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. So I want to ask you, Barbara, about the role of anger or the history of anger when it comes to religion. You begin with Buddhism, talking about Buddha's admonition to abandon anger, just get rid of it, forget about it. We get to the Stoics with Seneca saying, you know, we can make a rational judgment to choose to destroy it, to obliterate it so that it's not fogging our judgment. I'm interested how those notions are then applied to the notion of a deity. Is it possible for God to be angry? We have Hebrew scripture, we have Christianity and the Gospels that weigh in various from various right. perspectives about this. How does anger relate to God and to human beings' notion of religion?
That's a fantastic question, of course, huge. And different religions will have different takes on it. In the Western tradition, once you get past what we call paganism, I mean, the multiple gods of the Greco-Roman world, where you have gods that get angry and you have gods that use people as their messengers for the anger. In the Christian, the Judeo-Christian tradition, there's a real ambivalence because the Jewish God, that is, the God of the Old Testament, what's the Hebrew scripture for Jews, is often angry, but human beings don't really have the right to be angry. And if you look at Job, he suffers horribly, terribly, and his neighbors tell him, curse God and be done with it. And he does at one point question God, but he's an example of righteous behavior in the face of the inexplicable. Actually, God isn't angry at Job. He's just testing Job. But there is a lot of angry God in the Hebrew scripture.
And you point out the connection, if you will, between love and anger. You write that Christianity brought a jaundiced view of anger to the classical world in that God could not love and reward the good without the capacity to get angry and punish the bad. So in this sense, is anger a prerequisite to love? Can you have love without anger?
Not according to the mainstream Christian theologians, and they make a very interesting point, which is because Christ is the Lord who loves absolutely, without really expecting anything, because there is no good reason for Christ to give up his life, that is, for God to give his son, to sacrifice his son. Human beings don't deserve it. They sinned. That sin is with them forever. But the gratuitous gift of God, the loving gift of God, is to give his son in sacrifice. And that love is so full, so complete, so absolute as to brook no questioning. God cannot not love. But by the same token, those who fall away from God, God must punish because they are sinful. And so God cannot but be angry at their sins, and they must do penance for their sins.
On 88.1 WYPR, it's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. We're listening to an interview I recorded last month with Dr. Barbara Rosenwein, a professor emerita at Loyola University Chicago. We're talking about her latest book, Anger, The Conflicted History of an Emotion. A reminder that because our conversation was pre-recorded, we're not taking any new calls, emails, or tweets. You also bring up interesting observations about the relationship between anger and class, in that in feudal times, only the landed gentry, the people with money and the people with social status, had the option of being angry. Nobody else was even sort of allowed to be angry.
It's not
until we have, you know, the 18th century, people like philosophers like Hume and Smith, their thoughts cross the Atlantic, become part of the American tradition. And in a way, it's the great equalizer. When social classes are equal, it hints at, you write, it hints at the equality of races and genders, because everybody is all of a sudden getting equally angry. That's fascinating.
Well, the lower classes can fuss and fume. Also, let's bring in women. I mean, the idea that women can fuss and fume and their tongues can wag, but they aren't truly angry. In that sense, you see, because anger has a moral, virtuous quality. And so when the elites impose that idea, then other people who get violent or who act as we would today, we would say they are angry. But you, if you're an elite knight and your serf starts to behave in ways that we today would call angry, you would say would be a totally unjustified temper tantrum type of fury that had nothing to do with the righteous anger that an elite person could have.
Yeah. So this notion that you have to have status in order to be insulted.
Exactly.
If your status is so low, you can't even be insulted, which of course is just dehumanizing.
That's right.
Talk about anger management and what the purpose of this is, what the aspiration of this is, and how this fits into this history.
Yeah, good. Thanks for asking. I think before talking on this show, I typed in Maryland anger just to see what I would find. And what I found were a million anger management classes. Anger management is a really important part of our society, and that goes back to someone like Seneca, and then the Neo-Stoics who picked up on Seneca in the 16th and 17th centuries. We need to control our anger. That's a very important thread of the whole history of anger. But there are many kinds of anger management philosophies. And in my book, I talk about a hypothetical case study and how different therapists would approach the hypothetical case that's given, sort of Anthony M., I think is his name. And they have different takes. We've got a Buddhist therapist, for example, Anthony is hypothetical, who would try to show Anthony his inner Buddha self, who would give Anthony various exercises to transcend his anger. And that's different from, for example, some behavioral psychologists who would have Anthony sort of recreate the conditions under which he would get angry and then desensitize him slowly over time. Though that's very different from finding your Buddhist inner self. So anger management, unbeknownst to itself, has roots within the whole history of anger, the attitudes that we have towards anger, and the sense that we have about whether anger is good or bad.
How about the relationship between anger and power? You write that anger has become a metaphor for power, particularly in terms of gender, with women wanting to adapt the male mode of anger and comport themselves, express themselves that way to to achieve equality. Or so we think about when a Nancy Pelosi or an Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez gets angry or gets, firm and stern, people freak out at that. what is that relationship between anger and power?
Of course, as the history of anger shows, and as you've just already pointed out, it was the elites who had the right to get angry. And mainly those elites consisted of men. And women have become cognizant of this. And some women have recognized the powerful metaphor of claiming anger to be theirs as well as men's. But I don't think most women actually, even today, do show anger. I mean, there are certain ways that men show anger, and I don't know that women today have yet quite mastered it, and I'm not sure it would be a great idea for them to do so, because I actually think that men might adjust their show of anger to the way women show it, and that would be a salutary change in our power structure as it exists today. And I'm kind of keen on Biden not showing the same sort of angry face as Trump did. And so far, he has met my expectation. You can be firm and you can be righteous without yelling or pointing fingers or giving what in America is a characteristic angry facial expression.
Yeah. Well, You know, in my other life, I was a classical musician. I was a conductor. And I always used to tell, and I used to tell my orchestras and my choruses, if you really want to be heard, if you really want to be paid attention to, play softly. You know, the screaming and yelling only gets you so far. We have time for one more call. I hope Freddie is calling from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday. Thanks for your call.
Thank you for having me. Just like to thank the professor for her presentation. I think it's a really interesting topic. This kind of nexus between religion and anger, and it got me thinking about Freud. Actually, speaking of religion, Freud has some treatises on religion of his own, and I was wondering if the professor had looked at, you know, Freud's theory of aggression within the human psyche and anger management in that sense.
I did look at that a little bit, but since Freud, and I'm so glad that you brought Freud up because he's very dear to my heart, but as a matter of fact, Freud is kind of passé nowadays, and so very few scientists ever invoke him and that sort of thing. The interesting thing about Freud is that his aggression, which is an instinct or a drive, is connected to death. He sees it as almost in the way that Seneca saw it. It not only destroys others, but it destroys ourselves. And so he opposes Eros, love, and its connectivity, its way of associating, its way of melding against Thanatos, which is sort of the destructive impulse. Anger, per se, isn't so much what I found Freud talking about. In fact, the word, but of course, you have to look it up in German, Wut, for example, in German. It doesn't come up all that much in Freud. Freud is much more interested in fantasies, and usually fantasies connected with Eros. But did you have some ideas about it?
Got me thinking, and I was in the car when this struck me getting some lunch, but and also I recently read The Civilization and Discontent again after like 10 years or something, and I said, you know, Freud defines guilt in an interesting way, and that is the fear of losing a community. And so I guess when you were talking about how, you know,
back
in all
to
of these
fear
scriptures,
right.
the fear of losing the love of the community.
Yeah, well, that's a great point, Freddie, and I appreciate that, and good for you to get through that book. I tried a couple of times and didn't make it, so I'm proud of you. Dr. Barbara Rosenwein, the book is called Anger, the Conflicted History of an Emotion. Barbara, this has been fun. I really appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. I enjoyed it. Thanks.
Coming up, theater critic J. Wynn Russick joins me with reviews of a couple of new virtual theatrical events at the Roundhouse Theater and the Signature Theater. It's on the way after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's Midday. Stay with us.